Hey, Leela.
Hey, Hannah.
How's it going?
It's gone good.
We are back.
We are finally back. It feels good to be back.
I know. Season two.
Yes, we got a lot coming up.
Mm-hmm. Well, Leela, you know how I love me a good TED Talk.
You do.
So I was scrolling down YouTube and came across this talk, and it was given by this gorgeous Black woman, and it was called Confessions of a D-Girl.
D-Girl.
Yeah, a D-Girl. Okay. So I was wondering what that was. It was out of TED Stanford University. I had to check it out.
The A-Girls. These are the hottest of the hottest.
What?
The B-Girls. These are fine girls. Long natural hair, must have light skin. Beyonce is the prototype here.
Beyonce, okay. Okay, what's going on here, Hannah?
The C girls. These are African American girls, can't have extensions, must be medium to light skin toned.
Okay, so they're obviously looking for just a certain type of girl. For what? For what reason? What's going on?
So I scroll all the way down to the last category, the D girls. These are African-American girls, poor, not in good shape, must have a darker skin tone. A darker skin tone.
This was the casting call for extras for the 2016 film Straight Outta Compton. It told the story of the hip-hop group N.W.A.
Oh, so those are their standards of status and beauty. Straight, long hair, light skin.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. And it all goes back to a nasty 8-letter word, colorism.
We got to stoop this out.
Let's do it.
The stoop.
The stoop.
The stoop.
The stoop.
Stories from across the Black diaspora
that we need to talk about.
My cousins were water and grease girls, and I couldn't be a water and grease girl.
That's what I'm talking about, ballerina in the hood.
We be Gullah Geechee United people.
When a Black woman walks up to the desk in labor, what preconceived notions do you have about her?
I didn't even know we had a hair chart.
The stoop. So Leela, that casting call, thankfully, it did cause an outrage after it went viral. Folks were pissed. But it left people like Chika Okoro thinking. She's the woman who did that TED talk called Confessions of a D-Girl. She was doing her MBA at Stanford when she made that talk.
Okay, so she wasn't looking for a gig at that time.
Okay. No, but she was wondering what kind of role would she get if she auditioned. And she's dark-skinned.
So she would have been that D-girl, the poor, out-of-shape girl that they were looking for.
Yep, and that hit her hard.
That casting call really did affect me. And literally, I would say, it's like I read that casting call and I'm like, that's what I'm going to talk about.
I wanted to find this girl. Looked around and I did find her. And we talked about that TED talk she made.
I was obsessed with Straight Outta Compton. I really did see it in theaters 3 times. I just loved the movie so much. Even though I didn't grow up in Compton, but whatever. Being a Black person from LA, I felt seen through that movie. So then when I saw that casting call, it really did really affect me and really did kind of felt like, I don't know whether it's a stab in the back or a slap across the face, because I was kind of like, all right, this is a movie that's for me. It's a movie that gets me. Then to that casting call and it's like, oh wait, it's not really for you. Even in this corner where I feel like, yes, finally, people that get me, Straight Outta Compton, this movie, even there, I'm not quite accepted.
But Chika also says that feeling that the casting call brought up, it was very familiar because it's something she's lived with all her life. Colorism.
A lot of people confuse racism with colorism.
Yeah.
Colorism, it's kind of this discrimination based on your actual skin color.
Mm-hmm.
And it happens within our Black community. It doesn't always come from the outside, from another racial group.
Chika, she's Nigerian-American, she grew up outside of L.A., she says she didn't really feel the colorism within her family's, you know, social circles. But then,
like, in school, or even when I got older and started having more Black friends and being more in Black settings, think at around, you know, 15, 16, it was so prevalent. And I remember one of my friends in high school, like me, my friend, she's also, you know, African-American, Black American, pretty similar shade to me. So, you know, very dark skin. And then we had another friend who she was mixed. She's Black and Mexican, I believe. And I remember like walking through the mall. And then my friend that was kind of darker skin, she pulled me aside and was like, oh my gosh, everyone's gonna talk to so-and-so, like our lighter skin friend. I'm like, and I was like, why? Like, why'd you say that? She's like, because she's light-skinned. Don't you know that? Like, everybody likes light-skinned people. And when she said that, I was like, oh my gosh, you're right.
I remember a common compliment I would often get in middle school and high school, often told me by other Black males. It went to the effect of, oh, you're so pretty. For a dark-skinned girl.
For a dark-skinned girl.
Pretty for a dark-skinned girl. That is hard for a teen to hear.
Hard for an adult to hear, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So what Chica did, she thought of another way to be, quote, pretty.
I was so fixated on my hair. And I wanted nothing more but to have long, silky hair. Like, literally, like, I prayed for it. I cried for it. Because I always thought that was my way into being beautiful. You know, I can't be light. I'll never be light skin. But, you know, I can have long hair. I can be beautiful.
So Chica went to Harvard, then Stanford. She even had her long, straight weave when she gave that TED Talk.
Models must have real hair, no extensions. Well, since I have 20 inches of Brazilian hair extensions on my head, doesn't quite apply to me.
But she didn't feel quite right. Something was off.
Even just when I did the whole TED Talk, it was definitely a moment of transition for myself. Here I am really wanting to embrace myself, embrace who I am. But it's almost like, how can I do that when I'm still, you know, wearing all these weaves and extensions and braids? And so I was like, you know what?
What?
I'm gonna cut off all my hair.
She did it.
The big chop, transition time.
Yes, she did. And she says that empowered her.
It was really good for me to be able to say, you know, I don't need that. I don't need to buy into that belief that there's only one way to be beautiful.
That is super empowering, right?
Yeah. So she says she feels better, but the colorism still hurts.
I think it's a journey to shed that feeling, right? And I'm definitely, I'm on that journey. I'm not quite there yet. I honestly think this TED Talk and everything that's come from it is part of that journey to try to let some of that, I guess, hurt, to try to just kind of let that go. Like I said, me cutting my hair was a big part of that. But it's still, you know, it's still there. You know, like me and my friends, I have my group of, you know, strong, beautiful Black female friends. A lot of us are single and just, you know, it's really easy sometimes to spiral down that hole of like, damn, why are we single? Well, maybe, you know, maybe if we look different, you know? So it's almost like it's that gremlin in the back of your mind that creeps up when you're at your lowest point. Then you have to remember, like, no, gremlin, I'm not gonna listen to you. Like, I'm not gonna let you get the best of me, but it's something that I have to actively remind myself that, you know, that's not true. I'm not going to believe that. But yeah, it's always there.
What is that? What is that with that? You did not bring in a brown paper bag.
I sure did. So I talked to this historian. Her name is Allison Hobbs. She writes about colorism, and she wrote this book on passing as white. It's called A Chosen Exile. She says this brown paper bag test was used all over the place in the 40s and 50s.
For a number of clubs and other organizations, even churches, in order to be admitted, you had to pass a brown paper bag test. And essentially, that was exactly as ridiculous as it sounds, that someone would hold a brown paper bag, and if you were lighter than the paper bag, or if you were the same color or lighter, then you were accepted. If you were darker then you were not. And it wasn't just brown paper bag tests. I mean, I've also read about comb tests where someone would run a comb through a person's hair. And if the comb snagged, then the person would not be accepted. But if it kind of went through very smoothly, then they would be accepted.
Okay, so when she's saying this, I'm having flashbacks. Oh. I'm having some flashbacks to like, I don't remember if it was cousins or friends, but us putting the comb and that little black comb in the hair to see if it would go through all the way or if it would stop,
really?
You know, get caught on the kinks.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it would go all the way through, you
then
know,
what?
You had the straighter, softer hair, but all our hair was relaxed anyway.
The hair was relaxed and you still did the comb
yes,
test?
Yes, I don't know what we were doing back
How
then.
How old were you?
We were little kids, Aww. You know, 9, 8, something Aww. Like that. Yeah, but yeah, I remember this.
Well, Allison Hobbs is talking about the 40s and the 50s, maybe all the way up to the 60s. But she says we got to go even further to see when this all started. She says, you got to go all the way back to slavery. Enslaved women were often raped by their white masters, and then they'd have children.
The master would give their child preferential treatment. They might even pay for that child to become educated, to help that child to live a different life than what a normal experience would have been for an enslaved child. So we can imagine that if there's a group of children, if they are the child of a master, and if they are receiving preferential treatment, and partly that's because they appear to be closer to white than other children, then this kind of hierarchy, this kind of division is going to begin.
And that hierarchy became part of the fabric of society. It was ingrained in our psyches mm. that the whiteness in you makes you better. Hiyella, as my dad used to call it.
Many African Americans who were lighter skinned recognized the privileges that they had by being lighter skinned and chose to marry other African Americans who were also lighter skinned. There are many stories of parents who worked very hard to make sure that their child would only choose someone who was at least as light skinned as their child was, if not lighter. It was almost like equivalent to marrying up. Marrying light.
I gotta say, I heard and saw it so much in my family photographs and in our family background. It was like you'd see a lot of these very light-skinned women with darker-skinned men, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it was always like this conversation that no one would really have. It was super interesting because this is my family.
Yeah.
And they were all the light-skinned people, you know, my grandma, my aunts, like my all those folks were very, very light-skinned.
Uh-huh.
It was just something we never talked about, but we all knew like that lineage, like that those relatives, my grands were all like could basically like pass for white and it was considered a good thing.
Mm. Interesting. Crazy. But you never talked about it, but you knew it.
I just knew it. I just knew that was part of the reason why they had the lifestyle that they did, you know?
Privilege.
You throwing that word out to me. But yes.
I'm asking.
Yes, they were, my family was they were definitely a more upper middle class black family. And I think a lot of that had to do with the color of their skin. They had just more access
mm-hmm.
back then.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone wondering my white niche's regimen. I usually start off with the papaya soap. And then I'll let it sit on my face for about like 5 or 10 minutes. And then I'll get my exfoliation glyph. People forget to go under their eyes and there's like, you have the raccoon eyes because everywhere around your face is lighter than your eyes. So try and get as close around the eyes as you can. And I usually get the neck. Really good. back of the neck.
That's a video by a guy named Frank White.
Frank White?
White.
Okay.
I know. I mean, that's the name he has on YouTube. I don't know if it's real. But he does these videos teaching people how to lighten their skin because, like, he's doing that too.
Mm-hmm.
And one big product that he uses is called Whitenicious.
Whitenicious?
Whitenicious.
Whitenicious?
Like white and delicious or white and
nutritious?
And I don't know.
Okay.
It ain't nutritious. But
straight up whitenicious.
Whitenicious.
People are changing their appearance to look lighter and even whiter.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the drugstore and you see these fade creams. The words, you know, brighten and lighten are all over the skincare aisle wherever you go. There's prescriptions you can get to lighten your skin tone.
And those are marketed as dark spot lighteners, right? They're approved by the FDA, but then there's that stronger stuff, the bleaching creams.
Yeah, creams and lotions and ointments that are just harsh on the skin. Some of them peel the skin. Some of them have melanin inhibitors.
Melanin inhibitors.
Yeah. These actually block the production of melanin. And melanin is what makes our skin the color it is.
I mean, but we're inhibiting the melanin.
Right.
Basically like bleaching out our body's natural protection against cancer.
Bleaching out the blackness.
That is so sad. I just can't get over that term. It sounds like so wrong to me.
Mm.
Erasing the blackness.
Mommy, wow, you have the most beautiful glowing skin.
Now I have visibly fairer skin, making me feel younger.
Nivea Natural Fairness Body Lotion for visibly fairer skin. Nivea.
That's an ad by Nivea for a, quote, fairness lotion. And the ad shows a black lady with a really clearly, I think, African English accent who uses the lotion and voila, she becomes fair.
Like she rubs it on her leg and it actually becomes lighter,
becomes
like whiter
lighter.
With, you know, her movement up her leg. It just starts turning white.
Magically. And because of that, she's more beautiful, Leela.
Nivea was blasted for that ad.
Yes.
And lots of cosmetic companies have been blasted for this type of crazy, right? Like Dove was another one.
Yeah, but this ad was specifically targeting the African market. Whitening creams are huge there, especially in West Africa. In Mali, in Senegal, in Togo. The World Health Organization has said that in Nigeria alone, 77% of women are using them.
Mm.
It's a $10 billion industry worldwide, and it's mostly in Africa and Asia.
That is such a huge market. That's insane.
Huge.
There's a huge demand for this stuff.
Yeah, but that same WHO report warned that the mercury in a lot of these creams can cause kidney damage, it can cause depression, anxiety, even psychosis.
And then there's this chemical, how do you say it, Hannah?
Quinone.
Hydroquinone.
Mm-hmm.
And they use it in the creams, and it can cause cancer.
Mm-hmm.
It's been banned in the EU and Japan and Australia for years, and more recently, it was banned in the Ivory Coast and in Ghana.
I mean, they can ban all they want. Honestly, people are going to get their creams, whether they smuggle them. Mm-hmm. I've seen women, you know, go overseas and bring their creams with them. Nobody stopped them in the airport. Nobody said anything.
Yeah.
And you go to some stores here, some African stores, some Arab stores, they have them.
In Oakland.
Here in Oakland, in Richmond. So it's like you can ban them, but what does that really do?
والله إننا صوبات بتيجي من نيجيريا اللي هي موفيد سيفيك.
أنا. I'm confused. Oh, where did we just go? What was he saying?
All right, so when I visited my family in Sudan last year, I wanted to see what places sold these creams to women. This man's name is Salah Ad-Din, and he has this, like, a really small, like, a kiosk, not really even a shop,
mm-hmm.
and it's on the side street. He's telling me about the things he sells, the lotions, the hair gels. He even has these prescription ointments, although he's not a pharmacist, and these bleaching creams that come from places like Nigeria and China.
البيت تشتري لها حاجة من السوق يعني أبسط حاجة يعني الوش إنه تقريبا.
He's saying women come every day to buy the stuff, and even if they can't afford a full bottle or a full jar, they can pay him in installments. Some women come with literally a spoon to scoop some out and use it just for that week, because that's all they can afford. But the point is, they got to get their creams.
They're bleaching by any means necessary.
Yeah.
Did you talk to any women that bleach?
Actually, I have many female relatives who bleach.
بالليل قبل ما أنام بمسح الكريم بتاعي الخلطة.
So this relative wanted to stay anonymous because it's, you know, it's taboo to talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
She's showing me her creams. One is called Diana. One is called Kelly. And she's dabbing them on as she's done every night for the past 20 years.
Oh my gosh, is she white?
She's very light-skinned. I can show you her picture.
Okay, let me see.
This is her.
I just think she looks beautiful. I mean, dark skin, light skin, high yellow, low yellow.
Medium yellow?
I don't even know if there's a low yellow, but she's pretty.
I asked her to look in the mirror and tell me why she uses the cream, how it makes her feel. She says she feels confident and clean and naira. Did you hear that word, Naira?
Yeah.
Naira, Naira.
Naira means glowing and beautiful. And it's a word you hear a lot in women's circles in Sudan because it's the ultimate goal, that you have glowing skin. Naira. So the word white didn't really come up, but that's, you know, that's what was happening. She was definitely whiter than I'd seen her before.
Yeah. So it sounds like bleaching is just part of life in Sudan and in different parts of Africa.
It is. And it feels like if you don't use the creams, sometimes, like, you're the odd one out. People will let you know.
Hi, Hanna.
I know that voice.
Mm-hmm.
That's your hairstylist, Marie.
Yes.
The braider. And so we're back in the Bay now.
Yes. You know I had to ask her about this.
I love me some Marie.
Right? She's from Senegal, where nearly a third of women bleach their skin. Mm. All her friends do it back home and here in the States. So I asked her why she thinks they bleach.
Do you want me to be honest?
Yes.
Because a lot of women think that men are attracted to lighter skin women. They think that, you know, being lighter skin means beauty.
Hannah, okay, so I gotta say, it seems like there's this pressure to be lighter, but it's mostly put on women. Like Marie was saying, to, quote, look good for men.
Yeah.
It's something I relate to. I saw this in my own family. My dad, darker skinned man, always going out with, like, lighter skinned women. It was just something that I had been around, and I never even really thought about it until I got older, like how maybe it was so ingrained in how we were brought up.
Mm-hmm.
Like the things he'd say, you know, stay out of the sun.
Mm.
You're going to get black. Why would you want to get blacker? So does Marie bleach her skin?
She doesn't. But she surely has been tempted. Her friends tried to get her into it.
They were like, oh, Marie, you know, this is not going to make you light. It's just going to make your skin nice and glowing and stuff like that. So I was like, no. But then when I see them at events, they look so good. I'm like, I think I'm going to change my mind pretty soon. Because, you know, I mean, the makeup and all that. So I was kind of tempted. But then I thought about it. I'm like, you know what? Let me just be me. Let me do me, be me, and be happy.
Mm.
Yeah, I left it alone. Mm.
So even Africans here in the U.S. bleach their skin.
Yeah.
Not just back home. There's this social pressure to conform.
Yeah. I mean, African immigrants, you know, we are really kind of insular communities, and folks influence each other a lot. You do what your friends do, you know? And if they can't find these creams here, they get that harsh stuff back home. And again, it feels like it just all comes back to colorism, that being closer to white makes you more beautiful, gets you admiration and respect, even within your female, you know, circles, within your group, within your girlfriend group. Right. So it's not just about men.
Yeah, and this sounds like something we've been fighting against for decades. You know, there's racist laws in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and colonial ideas in Africa. And it sounds like a lot of people are buying into that notion that whiter is better. And they're not even, like, realizing it.
Right. But, okay, so what? But if society is telling us that to be successful, to be heard, to be valued, to be considered beautiful, you gotta be lighter, right? If I'm hearing all of this, can I really blame them?
Blaming the victim.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it. Because, you know, you go on Facebook, you go on Twitter, and you hear really harsh words said against these people who bleach. Like, you're a cultural sellout. You know, this is a self-hating black person. It's gone to the extent of, I've seen, you know, coon. And it's like, well, what made these people have to resort to bleaching?
Yeah, we should be going back and asking that question.
Right? And it's good that some people are asking these questions. There's a psychology scholar named Christopher Charles. He's at the University of the West Indies. He studied bleaching in Jamaica. And he says it's an epidemic there, but that we have to think deeper. And he says, look, when you pathologize people who lighten their complexion, you ignore the racism and colorism and the system that incites them to do this. I brought out my brown paper bag again.
Ooh, the bag.
The bag.
Why do you have that bag?
Well, I mean, I wanted to ask you something. When I put this bag against my skin, I mean, I definitely would not have made it into any social club in the 40s. But I feel like when you put it against your skin, you know, you have that high yella.
High yella.
High yella. And so I'm wondering, you're light-skinned. You said your family, you come from a light-skinned kind of lineage of women particularly. Have you felt this privilege that we've been talking about?
I mean, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I do. I don't know in what ways. I can't really pinpoint in what ways, but I do feel that there were certain, especially in school, there were certain white kids that felt more comfortable hanging out with me because I was lighter, because I talked whiter. Mm. But I definitely do, when I look back and I remember like the cafeteria, there's definitely like some darker skin black kids in school that weren't part of certain groups.
Mm-hmm. So they were kind of otherized, but you were not.
Yeah. Yeah. Hmm. What about you?
I've definitely felt privileged in my community.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if it's not because of color. It's because of tribe, maybe. It's very tribal back home.
Right.
There's a tribal hierarchy. You know, coincidentally, or maybe not so much so, the people at the top of that hierarchy are the tribes that are lighter, that are closer to where, like, Egypt in the north, or to the east, the Arabian Peninsula. And as you go kind of lower in that constructed, evil social hierarchy, it does get darker.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I definitely felt it as well.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel good.
It doesn't feel good.
No.
It makes me like well up inside thinking about it, that I might have experienced more privilege than other black kids at school and things like that because people felt more comfortable with me.
Mm-hmm.
And girl, I feel like that has something to do with why I have a natural hairstyle, why I, you know, don't care about laying in the sun now. And, you know, why I make some decisions I do about my blackness. So colorism definitely still exists.
Yes.
Is there any hope anywhere here, Hana. I mean, because if the whole solution is like dismantling racism and, you know, tearing apart the system, then this is going to take a while.
That historian, Allison Hobbs, that I spoke to earlier, she is hopeful. She thinks we're in a special moment right now, actually, that it is a time of kind of racial tensions and colorism can be on the uptick because of the political atmosphere right now. But she says it's also the era of the new natural hair movement. It's the era of Fenty Beauty. You know what Fenty Beauty is,
Rihanna. Rihanna's line, yes.
People are recognizing that the change has to come from us, that we can't trust or have confidence in our political leaders. And that actually has created a stronger sense of empowerment among everyday citizens to act. Change can happen. And I hope that part of that change will be around creating a more inclusive America where people can feel that they belong and that they're beautiful and that they're intelligent and that regardless of what shade their skin is, that they have a lot to give.
And of course, we can't forget
Black Panther would be another example.
She said it. Wakanda.
I was waiting for her to mention Black Panther. Can we have a Black Panther praise break or something?
Yes.
You know it had to be part of this episode.
I could do that too.
I'm ready for war again. Okay.
Black Panther would be another example of a way that we're seeing a really positive image of blackness, creating a more inclusive and a more diverse images of black people, particularly black women. I think the success of Black Panther will go a long way in moving this conversation forward.
So yeah, and the effect of this film is real. It's a far cry from that casting call that Chika Okoro was mentioning before, the one she was traumatized by.
I saw Black Panther, and that was just such a beautiful moment to see Lupita and to see, you know, black women that are powerful and beautiful. It's so important. It literally just uplifts me.
And, you know, Chika, she got her MBA from Stanford. She's gone natural. And now she's a marketing manager at a beauty company in L.A.
Ooh, hook me up, Chika.
I know, right? I asked her what she sees when she looks in the mirror today.
What do I see? I see a person that's come a very long way in her journey of self-understanding, self-acceptance, self-courage, self-love. It's come a very long way. Like, I think about where I was 10 years ago, a very long way. But it's still growing and still has a ways to go. But someone who's very optimistic and hopeful in where she'll end up in her journey.
We don't have to passively accept what society tells us to think is beautiful. We can question it. We could challenge the status quo, because when we do, we get one step closer to broadening the standard of beauty and creating a society where the world can see that D-girls are beautiful too. Thank you.
And that's The Stoop.
The Stoop. I'm so glad we're back, Leela.
Yes.
The Stoop family includes editor Jen Chien, sound engineer Seth Samuel, music by Daoud Anthony.
Support for The Stoop comes from California Humanities, a nonprofit partner of the NEH. Find them at calhum.org.
Special thanks to the NPR Story Lab.
Our radio home is KALW in San Francisco.
There's more about today's episode at thestoop.org. See you guys next time.